I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Jessica Fraser, who's a research fellow at the Centre for Hindu Studies here and is lecturer in religious studies at the University of Kent. And she's incredibly prolific publisher and thinker and lots of activity, really. She's written Religion, Reason and Passion, which is a comparative philosophy text on Rupa Goswami and Gadamer, 2009, by Ashgate, which I would encourage you all to get hold of, indeed, from Amazon. And she's also the author of the Continuum Companion to Hindu Studies, if that's the correct title, which technically is edited by her, but actually 99% of it is written by Jessica. The rest of it, there are some parts which are some contributions by other eminent scholars. And that's an excellent piece of work. And she's also currently engaged in writing a philosophical history of the Vedanta tradition, which I very much look forward to seeing. And lastly, she is the editor she got of the Hindu Journal for Hindu Studies, which she got going in negotiation with the Oxford University Press many years ago, and is the effective editor of it, really, at the moment.
Along with Rembert,
yes, indeed, mm-hmm. Indeed. So, Jessica, very welcome to hear again, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say about Hindu theology.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm a bit I missed the discussion last week, so I'm jumping into something that you guys already have a history in, so forgive me for repeating or going back into issues that you perhaps found complete solutions to last time. I'm going to be a bit provocative and set up a definition. I'm going to give you a definition that you can then tear to pieces like eager lines, because it may be that definition is not correct. Someone said I should start with a personal anecdote, and I'm not sure I can think of any, but I will say this, that I've long been aware that there is no department or discipline I would be in other than theology and religious studies. Of course, as we know at the moment, departments around the country are rethinking what they want to call these departments, precisely because of the kind of issues that we're talking about here. What is theology? What is religious studies? What does it mean? But whatever this area is, I would not be in any other discipline. And something about that for me is to do with the idea that we have theology and we have religious studies. Something about the line I want to talk about here between what is confessional and what is non-confessional is actually essential to me to making this area important and meaningful, not just enjoyable, but intellectually rich and meaningful in the way it is. So I'm interested in this distinction, and I am interested in the idea that there are two separate things maybe that have to go, that benefit from going together. And I'll start off talking generally about what I think theology and what I think religious studies is, so that I can then move on from that to say what would be a Hindu theology specifically, not just what would it be to study Hindu culture, religious culture, but what would it be to be a participant in it in some way that generates theology. Okay, so I'm going to begin with a definition that I myself instinctively apply to theology, and thus also to Hindu theology. And then I'm going to try and interrogate that, or ask you guys to interrogate that definition. Okay, so I'm setting up theology in some ways in opposition to this notion of what is a way of doing or studying religion that is not theological, which I'm going to call, for practical purposes of the time, being religious studies. Okay, where religious studies is kind of a big bag into which we put a range of different ways of studying religion, but ways that we see as being not theology. Religious studies is the bringing to light, that's the exposition, analysis, and understanding of religious culture. It is one branch of what we might call intellectual history. And while it may use philosophical or social or other kinds of analysis, and may offer interpretations that do in fact expand upon the original ideas that it's studying, its goal remains essentially descriptive. Okay, this is the definition I'm proposing, or at least initially proposing. Understanding, as such, is not an activity that seeks to be part of or creatively contribute to the thing it's trying to understand. Okay, so the English student of Cervantes does not try and add to Don Quixote. Indeed, many understanders, people in religious studies, for instance, would see it this as inappropriate. Okay, so it would be inappropriate to try and creatively contribute to what you're trying to understand, particularly inappropriate for religious studies in its modern descriptive, sometimes called phenomenological form. Because understanders, as it were, including religious studies and people in intellectual history, often hold to a respect for the object that seeks to maintain it in its autonomy. Okay, so in religious studies, we hold to a respect for the religious culture and an effort not to overwrite that culture with our own ideas or interpretations. Indeed, to some extent, the notion of epoché or bracketing off our own ideas and prejudices, interpretations, etc., and the respect for the autonomy of the culture itself. I don't get to tell you what Hinduism is or impose my interpretation in such a way that Hinduism, as it actually exists, gets, as it were, overwritten or obscured by my interpretation. To some extent, that whole process of bracketing can be seen as precluding religious studies, descriptive intellectual history, from theology. It means it by definition, is separate from what I'm going to define as being theology. In this sense, religious studies is methodologically an outsider practice. Now, of course, before I go on to what theology is, of course, a religious studies outsider may decide that his or her interpretation of the tradition... A religious studies outsider may want to add his or her interpretation to the tradition, or their interpretations may be used to add to the tradition. Okay, so if I've interpreted Hinduism in this way, and I want to sort of plug that interpretation back into the tradition. I want my interpretation of the Bhagavata Purana now to determine the way that the continuing Hindu religious tradition of living with the Bhagavata Purana does what it does. Okay, so my academic exposition should, in fact, influence theology. I might say that. Or an insider may want to do that. They may say, oh my gosh, I just read that book on, Kashmiri Shaivism, and now I understand it better. I want to use that descriptive understanding to try and do my theology in a new way. That's perfectly fine. But in so doing, they take that purely descriptive religious studies understanding and take it over the boundary, out of the descriptive world of religious studies and into the creative discourse of theology. Theology, as academically understood, as opposed to religious studies and intellectual history, is the creative yet systematic contribution to religious doctrine. That's my definition, the creative yet systematic contribution to religious culture or doctrine. As an activity, it places itself within the creative life of the tradition and claims the right to participate in its growth and development. The word claims the right, I think, is important there. Where someone in religious studies would say, I really don't have the right. Like if I say, look, I think this is what Mirabai really is doing, I don't get then to go to people who are using her material in the ongoing creative life of their tradition to say, this is what you have to be doing with your own continuing development of this material. I can say, this is what I think she meant. And if they say, I think she meant something else, I can happily contradict them. But that's a matter of interpretation and not a matter of creative development further of the material. So theology, as academically understood, is the creative yet systematic contribution to religious doctrine. As an activity, it places itself within the creative life of the tradition and claims the right to participate in its growth and development. And I've said two things there that I want to hold to. Theology must be both systematic and contributive or creative. Theology, again, as academically understood, specifically here, is not simply the creative contribution to the tradition it creatively contributes, but it's not only that, it has to be systematic as well. Merely contributing to the tradition can involve a range of things, expressing, encouraging, and enriching the faith, and many preachers or artists or individuals simply reflecting on life are actively enriching, creatively contributing to their religious culture every day. They are, you know, there's a lot of ways to contribute creatively to your religious culture. Are they theologians? Not in the sense in which we've used it in the academic contexts. This is religious rather than theological discourse. Okay, so the artist who goes out and paints new pictures of Mary doing new different things is, insofar as they are simply expanding the creative cult, the culture itself, is doing religious work, but not necessarily theological work. I'll come back to the systematic idea. Theology entails a specifically systematic contribution, I would argue, that holds itself to some principle of coherent expansion of the faith. Okay, that's partly what makes it theological rather than merely creative. This is often philosophical theology, so we often think of that as the sort of prime example of what a theology is. It's philosophical theology, partly because that makes the coherence element most explicit, as in Shankara or Aquinas. But it can also be an implicit systematic reasoning. There are theologies or theological elements embedded within the Netra Tantra or Dante's Paradise and Inferno. Okay, they don't aim explicitly to produce a coherent discourse, but actually one of the things that they're doing along the way in their narrative or in their other kinds of discourse is giving you a coherent account that in some sense holds itself to a principle of making sense, of coherence, of systematicity. When we talk about the theology of Augustine or of Alama Prabhu, we are not referring, when we talk about their theology, the theology of Augustine or Alama Prabhu, we're not referring to the quality of their poetry. We're not referring to the character of their personal experience. In talking about their theology, we're referring to the system of shareable ideas that they expound, a system of ideas. This definition of theology sees it as a truth. Okay, so that's one thing. I've stressed that it's a creative expansion of tradition that claims that authority and meaningfully contributes in a way that I think religious studies would not see itself as being able to do by definition in its discourse. And also that it has a systematic element that gives it its specifically theological dimension. This definition of theology sees it as a truth-engaged activity, unlike the descriptive or interpretive human sciences, i.e. it's kind of confessional. Confessional not in the sense that it's just expressing ideas of truth, but it's engaging with the truth value of the material. This is different from the descriptive or interpretive human sciences, of course. By and large, they don't seek to engage with the truth value of the material that they're looking at. The human sciences, natural sciences, of course, do different things. One of the few disciplines that it stands close to is analytic philosophy. Interestingly, theology and analytic philosophy have a certain shared link. That is not the branch of philosophy that is effectively just intellectual history. That's part of philosophy. And that's just intellectual history of a form that uses its analytic skills to better understand the claims and context of particular systems, but doesn't actually engage with them as truth claims. So let's say an intellectual historian analyzes Kant, shows where there are inconsistencies, incoherences, and mistakes in his thinking, notes the points at which it fails to be systematically coherent, but it doesn't stop and say, and we think generally he's wrong. That's not its job. That's not the job of intellectual history. So it's part of that religious study side. Analytic philosophy, on the other hand, is the branch of philosophy that engages with, checks, passes judgment on, and empowers itself to contribute to reject or alter its material in pursuit of an improved claim to truth. So this came up wonderfully when at a conference we had at the OCHS on Indian philosophy, and there was an interesting kind of axial difference between different participants, exemplified by Janardhan Gneri, who said, look, here's what Vaisheshika is doing, and here are some ambiguities or problems in it, but we can fix these problems or holes in its coherent system if we do this, this, and this. I'm going to contribute to it, and I'm going to improve it, because then it will be a closer truth system. And Johannes Bronckhorst, who kind of exemplified the intellectual history camp, said, why are you trying to add to Vaisheshika? We're just studying these ancient traditions. I'm not sure that you get to add to it. We're just observing things they've done. And Janardin said, well, what's the point of just observing them? We're trying to, you know, get some truth out of it. And Johannes said, we don't deal with truth. I don't know what subject you're in. And it kind of brought out a real difference, as it were, between those groups. So analytic philosophy actually does deal with truth claims in a way that kind of relates to theology, although it doesn't see itself as within the tradition. In this sense, theology and analytic philosophy are confessional discourses in religious studies, and the history of philosophy are descriptive ones. Now, to highlight this difference, one may contrast an English student with a poet. English student studying the poetry, the poet adds to it. A sociologist with a politician. A sociologist studies different systems. A politician tries to create them in many cases. A philologist with someone who tries to improve upon the rules of grammar. You may study the grammatical system of a certain culture. Most people don't go in and try and fix old Persian or something like that. But if you did, then you'd be stepping over that line. People may combine these activities, the two sides of that line, and it may even be fashionable to do so. There are trends for incorporating art theory into works of art. I go to the Biennale every year, which is a big modern art fair in Venice. And there are always artists who've gone and looked into the latest art theory and then printed it out and then torn it to pieces and then stuck it into their statue, and they're incorporating the theory into the actual creative artwork. Right? They've kind of played with that borderline. So it may be fashionable to mix it in that way. Or theorists may want to incorporate art. There's a great trend in French literary theory for writing in a kind of an evocative poetic style, which got lots of people very upset for a while. But there's a kind of a mix of the different genres, styles, discourses, and activities. But it doesn't mean that the goals and the principles and the methods of these two kinds of discourse are the same. I'm suggesting that they're genuinely different. And just to notice along the way that this definition locates the definition of theology in the goal of that particular discourse or text, okay? In the goals that determine the form of reasoning that the material adopts. This is different from the notion of theology as faith-seeking understanding. That's a very charming phrase, but I think it's probably problematic and probably wrong as a phrase. Faith-seeking understanding locates the defining feature of theology in the faith attitude and intention of the thinker. So if I have faith and I'm seeking understanding of my faith, whatever I do becomes theology. Now, the faith attitude and intention of the thinker may not show up in the text they produce. It may not be relevant to the message that that text is producing. I may want to seek understanding of my faith by doing a detailed analytic critique of Marx or a careful assessment of the linguistic techniques employed by Aurobindo in his interpretation of the Puranas. That may be a way that I seek my understanding, but the actual discourse of analysis that I use to check through Aurobindo's linguistic material is not itself theological. Right, so that would, if theology is faith-seeking understanding, anything a confessional person does becomes theology. And that seems patently untrue. Or else it turns everything into theology, which completely elides the distinction and gets rid of any meaningful definition. So I'm not sure about this faith-seeking understanding idea. So whatever Descartes himself was aiming to do, his text holds to certain rules of reasoning and conveys a certain message. That is, the text has its own assumptions, aims, or intentions that are not necessarily the same as Descartes' own Christian aims, assumptions, intentions. Kierkegaard exemplifies the kind of writer who explicitly uses this divide between the author and the text's goals. I'm getting into death of the author area here. Kierkegaard explicitly uses that distinction to create texts that where the text has a different intention from the author's text. He writes texts where he pretends to be someone else, and he writes in a style that is nothing to do with his own personal views. Indeed, he actively engages what he sees as a different, opposite, completely separate discourse that may be challenging rather than actually supporting his own interests and intentions. Okay, so he's a good example of someone who's himself a faith thinker, but his way of writing is to produce texts that do not that have their own kind of life, have their own goals. This means that a confessional insider can write descriptive outsider texts, so a theologian can do religious studies and vice versa. A theologian can act as a student of religion, and a student of religion can act as a theologian, producing texts in each of those genres regardless of their own personal orientation. So I could produce a theological text even if I'm not part of a faith group, and a theologian, a faith person can produce a religious studies text. That's what I'm claiming, I think. Just to point out one of the reasons I think why we've lost sight of that distinction, the trend for eliding the boundaries has had a significant impact on our loss of a sense of what theology is. One thinks of Plato and his wariness of poets, even though he himself was a very poetic writer. One can lose a sense of the rules of a certain discourse, for instance, induction and entailment, which are very philosophical, coherence-seeking things, as soon as you start to mix in other kinds of discourse with different rules, like analogy, allusion, wishful thinking, nice ideas. Right? If you mix them all together, you start to lose a sense that there are genuinely different kinds of discourse and rules in action here. Brian Hatcher has noted the way in which eclectic, quote-unquote, modern Hindu theologians, such as Vivekananda, and I think he'd add to that Gandhi and Aurobindo as well, the way in which those thinkers not only mixed different systems of thought, so let's say Vivekananda says, I'm going to have some Advaita, but I'm going to mix it with something else, and Aurobindo says, I'm going to take a bit of Tantra and mix it with some Purana and stick a bit of Advaita in there. They're eclectic in the sense of mixing different discourses, sources, but they're also eclectic in the sense that they're mixing genuinely different kind of discourses, styles, or methods of thinking. So they may mix different rules of reasoning, say philosophical coherence with social usefulness. Vivekananda does that quite a lot. He'll take something and says, this makes sense, and it's really useful. And sometimes he does that in such a way that you lose a sense of the two different kinds of rules that he's principles that he's applying. And they also, of course, often mix different styles of writing, a bit of poetry, a bit of textual interpretation, a bit of historical narrative, a bit of social prescription, all mixed in. They're often thus seen for this reason as bad theologians, in comparison with earlier philosophical theologians in the Hindu tradition. You know, people have tended to see Vivekananda as inferior to, say, Ramanuja, right? And I'm certainly myself not going along with that. One might say, rather, that they combine different styles into a multifaceted new form of discourse that has its own goals. I think they have reasons for mixing those discourses together. They actually have their own rationale and meaningful things behind them. So that's fine. They're actually coherent to a new set of rules, but those rules are implicit and people haven't wholly acknowledged that that's what they're doing. They're still holding them to the rules of previous thinkers. In any case, such cases have led us or contributed to our losing sight of the difference between the systematic theologian, the applied social thinker, the religious poet, etc. Okay, so that's me setting up my definition. I've suggested there's that big axis there. Now, a few questions in critique, just to start us off on critiquing that sort of suggestion. Is there a difficulty in requiring systematicness as a defining characteristic of theology? That is it right to turn all theology into systematic theology? I'm not sure I like that idea. I'm not sure myself. I recently started a project looking for theology among what I called grassroots theologians, everyday people doing theology, implicit theology, people who don't even realize they're doing theology. That is, everyday Hindu communities with no training in theology or any form of systematic reasoning explicitly informing what they do. These are what I've called naturally emergent theologies that just arise spontaneously. That is, theologies that are not intentionally developed with any explicit intent or claims, sometimes emerging wholly unconsciously from the activities of the community. As an example, I'm interested in, for instance, in the implicit theology behind or underpinning Trinidadian sacramental rituals for sacralizing nature. So people get to Trinidad, they haven't got access to any kind of Indian river, water, any of the materials that were part of ritual. What are they going to do? They just kind of develop as a community without anyone saying, let's do this or let's make sense of blah, blah, blah. They just kind of develop new rituals. Right. Interesting. And that's kind of a creative thing, you know, creative theological development. But there's no systematic, coherent set of rules that's automatically defining them. So overnight, isn't that not make sense in terms of what I've said? Or when I went to Thailand, wonderful example is that you'll have shrines to the gods and also to spirits, and they kind of elide the difference between the gods and the spirits. And those shrines just naturally develop. People come along over the course of, say, 10 years and leave different things there. And at the end, you get a site which has all these objects with different meanings, which when you put it together, kind of, as it were, creates a theology of that particular being. Right? Interesting, really fascinating. But there's clearly no ordering, coherent, rational system to which they're all subscribing in order to create this thing. There's no explicit authorial intention about the goals of the activity here, but they do hold themselves, so that would suggest that this is not theological on the definition I've given. But I would argue that they do hold themselves to certain rules that belie a conceptual system underpinning what they do. The Trinidadian Hindus didn't just randomly come up with anything, and you didn't just end up with a big chaos of material, people doing whatever they want with a range of different things. What happened actually is, over the years, sifting through which innovations they wanted and which they didn't, discussing and engaging, creatively appropriating, etc., something arose that showed that they did have certain guiding rules and principles behind what they were doing that meant they had to stay coherent to, for instance, a cosmology, or a sense of how ritual works, or a sense of how you should interpret the texts, or what have you. Right. And similarly with the Thai case, the way the shrines develop, and as you look at the range of them, you see there is a kind of a general order that is, in fact, behind what everyone's doing. So I'm saying there is an implicit theology. Here is the theological, I would argue, element. Not the experiential element, the devotional, the embodied or expressive elements. There are other elements, I'd say, that it's in that coherent system behind it that is the specifically theological element. Okay, and that's kind of part of that coherence links to why we do theology in universities often. So that's question one. Question two, I do think that there's an exchange between the two discourses. I've already said I don't think you should put them in separate faculties, or at least you shouldn't claim that they're totally, totally separate. I think it was John Hinnells who noted to his surprise that his academic interpretations of Zoroastrianism, Hinnells is a Zoroastrian scholar, his interpretations of it had been cited back to him by Parsis as part of Zoroastrianism. And he realized that by writing books about Zoroastrianism, he was creating Zoroastrianism. He was kind of shocked and surprised and confused and thought, gosh, I better be careful what I write because I'm actually creating the subject that I'm studying. Doesn't that mean that the boundaries are a mess? It's certainly true that theology uses descriptive interpretation, uses exposition of the religion itself to A, understand itself better, and B, identify new possibilities for what it could be saying. The theologian may go to someone else's exposition or do their own exposition in order to get a sense, A, of better understanding and of new possibilities. In either case, that discourse, the descriptive, expository religious studies discourse, is being appropriated as a tool of theology. It can be a tool of theology, and often is, in fact. But again, that's not the same thing as saying that it simply is theology. Okay, so when the person reads through John, when the community reads John Hinnells' books, and some of it they say to themselves, that seems completely wrong, and don't cite that. But other parts of it, they say, oh, yeah, that's right, and actually that shows me better, and oh, that makes sense. What they're actually doing is, according to existing coherence and systematic principles, they are creatively appropriating that understanding to contribute to the living life of their own tradition. Okay, so that's the moment in which the religious studies material is taken over the line into the other area. And it goes the other way. On the other hand, religious studies and intellectual history continue studying theology, even as theology is being done and created, even as it uses their own insights. So Hinnell's job, of course, once he realized that happened, was to go back and in a purely descriptive way say, oh my gosh, I better write a book about how Zoroastrians are using academic material to help create their own stuff. Right? So he's still using that material. They can study not only the systematic development in the past, but also the ongoing creativity of the tradition, the patterns that it follows, and its place within religion as a whole. I.e., they can study theology's liveness and confessional creative character. And that's fine, they're studying it. They're not themselves in that contributing to it, unless someone from within, perhaps them within, turns it into theology. Just to clarify, they may themselves, as a religious studies person, be inspired by what they're studying, provoked by it. They may be changed by it. They may be nourished by the options that the theology they're studying presents. It may change their life and inform how they live. But they would never put that into their own descriptive discourse. So the religious studies person who's terribly inspired by reading the Tao Te Ching, if they simply continue analysing as responsibly as possible the Tao Te Ching, they remain in religious studies. If they try and add to the Tao Te Ching, they become theologians, right? So let's say if I'm completely transformed by reading the Gita Govinda, by and large as a religious studies scholar, I would not then transform my own personal response into my academic religious studies analysis of it. And indeed, the idea is that if I did, I would be a rather bad scholar of religion. I might be a good theologian, but I'd be a bad religious studies person, and I think the discipline as a whole would condemn me wholeheartedly. Okay. Now, the last point simply is this. All of this that I've said so far derives from, of course, as you've already been thinking, the Western academic definition of theology. It derives from the Western academic traditions, not just its definition, but its whole history of engagement in doing theology. So we can say, on the other hand, what might a specifically Hindu form of theology be? How would a Hindu theology define itself? And I'm not going to give you a big answer to that. I'm mostly going to ask you. Of course, there is no word theology in Hinduism. I mean, you can find some cognate sort of ish stuff, but there is no such word, so let's not pretend that we should look for any single thing that is, in fact, theology. The question itself entails the Western-derived notion. We can look analogically for sort of analogous, similar clusters of concepts that fulfill related functions in India. And we could come up with a range of them. I have to write a chapter soon on the relationship between rationality and religion in Hinduism. And all of this goes into the area where we look at the relation between those two kinds of activity. One might refer to anvikshiki, sort of inquiry, philosophical inquiry, and tarka, philosophical debate, often of religious ideas, to determine their philosophical coherence. We might look at bhashya, commentary, a deeply theological expansion of a text, but in a way that's expected to be systematic rather than just personal and capricious. In a bhashya, you don't have someone just going, I feel a bit like this kind of like this. You're supposed to reason for a kind of a broadly, universally acceptable interpretation. We might talk about the darshana. I think it's an interesting word. And if you look at the notion of darshana as they are, systematic perspective, darshana you can translate, I like to translate, I think, as a perspective, a viewpoint, a systematic viewpoint of things. You might look at Shastra, which is the development of a science or a manual explaining something, expository, but with the implicit assumption that there's an application of it, an applied goal, kind of applied explanation. One might look at the whole theological structure that people usually focus on of the acharya, the teacher who instructs the shishya, the pupil, giving knowledge of the text, but also expository understanding of it. So let's say if you read the Vedas, you'll find linguistic explanation of the text, mythical explanation of the text, metaphysical explanation of the text. Okay, all of that together is part of the explanation. And also the acharya will usually give his student application tools for the text. The Veda Angas are actually mostly about how to use the text in some way for the ritual. So we have a series of different things going on there that follow a kind of a structure of teaching that we can recognise actually as similar to Western notions of what happens in theological activity. So that new truth assertive texts are produced by acharyas such as Ramanuja, etc. There is a requirement here for systematicness in a range of different ways in terms of how you deal with the text or how you produce coherent philosophical ideas, etc. But it is also a creative expansion. And just to note maybe that the acharya-shishya relationship is different from the guru relationship, say in tantric practice, where I think there is, I'm speaking randomly, but perhaps there are relationships where explanation and creative expansion systematically of the ideas are more important, and other relationships where it's the personal applied practice is more important. And I kind of think of the acharya relationship as engaging more with knowledge, discovery of underlying reasonings and expansion, whereas I think of the guru relationship as more involving the correct application of the material. That might be wrong. But I kind of raise it more to just suggest distinctions between different kinds of discourses that may exist even within the Indian context. So there are a range of Indian activities through the lens of which one might address issues that we think of as theology. And I might also argue that India has elements of its own religious studies discourse as well. India is often seen as not getting objective Western-style science-oriented sort of analysis. That's a widespread claim, critiqued indeed as well. But I think you can find elements of that. It's really interesting to read Madhva's Sarva Darshana Sangraha, where I think he does both. Madhva becomes a very good religious studies, philosophical an analyzer, if you like, of systems, when he expounds each of the 16 systems in the Sarva Darshana Sangraha. He tries to make sense of them. He tries to represent them as accurately as possible. Okay, and in that sense, he's on that intellectual history side. He's also in the same text of theologian insofar as he then orders the 16 systems in an ascending hierarchy where the ones that he thinks are best come at the end, at the top of the ladder, as it were. So that his actual text content is religious studies, but his text structure is actually theological because it's making claims about the value of the material within. So, what am I saying? I'm going to suggest that difference in discourse is a fundamental kind of a discourse, no, difference as it were, but I'm also going to suggest that you can combine them, you can step back and forth over that boundary and use them in different ways. And I also would suggest that they benefit from being together, and then I think I'd like to see perhaps what would be useful then would be to look at the Hindu context and get a cluster definition of the different things that Hindu theology can be. And I'd be very interested to hear if there's something within Hindu theology that we want to think of as theology for some good reason, but that doesn't fit this creative systematic reflection definition that I've proposed. Okay, I'm stopping there.
Thank you.
Anyone think of anything?
Well, thank you for that. That was very lucid and interesting and thought-provoking. I think I'm in agreement with you about that distinction, religious studies, theology. What was your definition of theology again?
I think it's the creative... it's a creative, systematic expansion of the tradition. Mm. Is the definition I had. There's the last paper. And I think that's it. Theology is academically understood as the creative yet systematic contribution to religious doctrine. As an activity, it places itself within the creative life of the tradition and claims the right to participate in its growth and development.
Yeah, and that's a crucial difference, isn't it? It actually participates in its growth and development. I don't think religious studies does, in a way.
Or if it does, I think that's not what it sees its goal, and it's not part of what the activity is supposed to be.
Although philology does, doesn't it? Philology improves the text through critical emendation.
Well, I think what we'd say is that what it doesn't want to do is change the content of the text. Mm.
It seeks to produce.
Well, that's often true. I think what they want to do is produce a text that's more suitable for analysis. Mm. But even a philologist would say, yeah, but let's also remember here are the different mistakes that are made, and let's try and see why Ramanujan made those mistakes. Mm. Perhaps it'll tell us which days of the week he was sleepy on or something. Mm. But they want to maintain all the material as material for analysis. Mm. So the creation of an improved text is actually for analysis rather than to create a new Ramanujan text. Mm. Mm.
With the theologian, he should be concerned with finding revelation, though. So would he be trying to refine the text and systemize it based on his own experience with revelation or moksha or whatever his pursuit is?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Maybe that kind of fits into the idea that if I'm claiming that the theologian isn't just someone who contributes to the tradition, like the poet who sits there and goes, oh, I see it, let me write it down, but that there's some systematic element, I think that the theologian is often a philosophical theologian, but also a textual theologian. And that means looking at that. What I suppose what that suggested that there are a number of different kinds of authority that a theologian will refer to as valid sources of their tradition. And each kind of authority entails certain rules of coherence. So the scriptural authority means that the theologian doesn't, in fact, have to look for their own personal revelation and follows certain rules of coherence that are to do with text interpretation. You could arguably, I think, have an empirical theologian who says, I'm going to go and expand on the tradition coherently, systematically, from my own personal observation. In some ways, you could argue that Descartes is trying to do something like that in the Cartesian Meditations, where he says, I want to figure out some things, answer a few questions that actually are really threatening Christian theology right now, and I'm going to do it by sitting here and looking at my own thoughts to try and find evidence of certainty. He's doing kind of an empirical, philosophical study of theology, and you could, in theory, do that with revelation of God. I think probably there are theologians who said, I'm going to go find God, check it out, and use this systematically to answer a couple of questions. I think there probably have been people who've done that. So what that suggests is kind of that you could have theologians who work on a set of different bases, and one of them might indeed be revelation. Though most of them not, of course, because that seems problematic. Most traditions have said, don't go out and look for yourself and then come back and do theology with it. We don't want you to do that. And, of course, the reason is that makes things complicated, because someone comes back and says, I totally checked, and God was a duck. And they're like, you can't check it. You can't, you know.
But if you have a system for that.
Yeah, there's no way of, you know. And so if you look at Mahayana Buddhism, if you look at many parts of the Hindu sampradayas, argue, you know, people used to interpret Shankara as saying, go out and see it for yourself. But actually, mostly Shankara doesn't say that. Most of the great acharyas say, read the Vedas, because the rishis saw it correctly and you might not. So there is actually, Kabbalah, for instance, is problematic. It's seen as controversial. So that mostly they don't necessarily want you to do that. People have.
I think you have to, when you were talking of what Hindus in Trinidad and Thailand and, you know, other places are doing, and you sort of seem to equate that or sort of place it in the same category as what, you know, scholars are doing in terms of as sort of theologians are doing in the academy.
It's like, but Shankara is Trinidadian Hindus, kind of the same.
As sort of contemporary
Oxford theologians,
you know, people in academics. Whereas I would be somewhat hesitant to put those two in the same category, because I mean it's sort of the question is basically, well, is there a difference between these two, or is the difference merely, I mean, you mentioned the lack of, you know, the fact that they're not very systematic or so, is that the only difference, or is there actually something more profound?
I think in this case I see it as being the creative element. So we were just saying earlier that, okay, what is a modern theologian? I think, or at least I'm claiming here, that the theologians in the Oxford Theology Faculty are specifically the ones who see themselves as understanding in the effort to genuinely contribute to, even if only in their own life, the Christian tradition, right, or whichever particular religion, but their own tradition. And so certain people fall into that, and some don't. Now, you're right, that's controversial, because that means people in church history, Christian history, then becomes religious studies. It's just history. It's not part of the creative development of the tradition. So suddenly I've just thrown all the historians into religious studies. And that's also true for a lot of the text scholars. I mean, I personally, if you ask me, when I studied the Old Testament in Cambridge, we were not studying it confessionally. In fact, the whole point of studying it in university was not to study it confessionally. And that meant you went through and you saw all the bits that were messy and indeed contradictory, apparently, to faith. Quote-unquote faith. I mean, actually, faith in reality can often accommodate those things. But, you know, in that sense, I'm probably putting them. Most of your New Testament and Old Testament scholars have suddenly been thrown into into religious studies as well. I think what they're doing is often meant then to be used for faith and the creative development of faith. So the traditional religious, traditional theology degree, you would study lots of stuff that's not confessional, creative stuff, systematic stuff, but you were then meant to use it for theological purposes in the long run, or it was meant to contribute to that. So there is a interesting complication, I think, within what a theology faculty is. But I also think that you mentioned Dermot McCulloch. I think Dermot McCulloch, as a historian of Christianity, sees himself not as a theologian, but as a historian of Christianity. And many people who do, for instance, patristics, would see themselves as theologians insofar as they're part of theology faculties, but not as creative theologians. And I think, in contrast to that, someone like, I don't know, John Milbank, who's trying to create new, you know, in a sense, creating new theologies, or when Marilyn Adams said, someone said, what are you doing in this faculty? And she said, I'm trying to understand God better. I'm not trying to find out more about the tradition. I'm trying to understand God. She was kind of stating something to do with being on the side of theology rather than religious studies. So I think that the line between the two definitely runs through contemporary theology faculties in a way that probably many would find controversial.
So you think there's a distinction between theology and academic theology? That's your point, isn't it, Rimpa?
Yeah.
You might be right.
But I mean, at the same time, I sort of don't like neat categorization because I don't think, you know, it really works that way.
But then why use any of the words?
I mean, yeah, they're useful up until a point, but I think, you know, as you mentioned, you know, sort of the boundaries between religious studies and theology are very difficult and vague and problematic at times. And, you know, it of course, depends on how you define these. And that's kind of what I was trying to do when I gave that talk 2 weeks ago, is basically say, well, people mean very, very different things by the word theology, and it's depending on what you use, it's you know, what understanding you use, that's going to shape the way you view the whole, you know, religious studies versus theology thing. But the fact that theology is you know, historically has changed so drastically in its meaning. And the way, you know, the way it's used today, yeah, sort of in a way, I.
See, in some departments you have theologians who happen to be ministers of church. So when they take theology, are they teaching from a faith-seeking understanding or from sort of an academic sort of approach to the subject?
I think it's a good question, and I think you go exactly to their courses and you very quickly see which kind of discourse they're engaging in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think my response to what you said is that I don't think we're disagreeing, I think we're agreeing, but what I'm trying to do is to say within the range of things in the theology pot, and indeed in the religious studies pot, there are genuinely different kinds of discourse. Genuinely different activities with holding themselves to genuinely different goals and rules and so on. So that while we can maintain what you're saying, which is there is a deep, rich complexity within the what's become the discipline definition of theology, that doesn't mean that we should lose sight of the really factually, logically different things that they're doing, as it were. And not to say that theologians actually, as people in theology faculty, have to do theology discourse, and religious studies people have to do religious studies discourse. I think it is more complicated than that. But to link that to what you said, I think if we went to the lectures by that person, we could see when they were doing religious studies and we could see when they started doing Christian theology. And I've been to lectures that start off as religious studies. This is what the text says, da, 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 and suddenly go, but actually what this is what the person means, and when they get to heaven they'll see this. And you're like, okay, you know, but I'd better not put that part in my essay about the meaning of Paul or whatever, because not everyone's going to agree with that, because that was his own personal creative contribution. So that you can see the discourse difference while maintaining that messiness within the theology sort of area. Messiness sounds like a negative word. Positive looseness.
Does it not also mean, though, that religious studies can have a critical dimension to it, in which case it is based on a certain assumptions about the nature of the world, the nature of truth or something?
I think that's an interesting point. And just to clarify for my own thinking, what do you mean by critical there?
I mean the clarification of error, the errors in human thinking, which is itself based on a certain kind of understanding of rationality or something. So.
I think that's true, but I think that's right, and in some ways that then is kind of the same kind of thing as philosophical analysis, like philosophy
of religion, isn't it?
I think kind of is. So you might then say, okay, so here's the idea, the thinker's ideas, here we've explained them in a range of ways, and now let's also look at whether they make sense, and let's clearly useful to see where they don't, and then flag that up. But I think you're still then... I think that most critical thinkers in religious studies wouldn't think Descartes got this bit wrong, so let's rewrite him. They'd say a proper understanding of Descartes shows us what he got wrong. And if you now want to go do philosophy, creative philosophy, you can produce a new philosophy based on Descartes that solves that problem. But you wouldn't actually want to change... You could put yourself in the Cartesian tradition and produce new material based on that. But in a way, that's what I think I'm calling analytic philosophy, that it's a creative theology rather than the intellectual historian. What you do get, just briefly, is the critical thinkers who might say, here's controversial examples, here's Hinduism, and it has this idea about women, and actually, as a critical religious studies thinker, having observed that thing, I see that it's ethically problematic, and I feel that that should change the tradition. That's critical religious studies slipping over into a kind of a theology, though most religious studies doesn't try and do that, and I think it's controversial where it does, and I think a lot of people would see that as certainly separate from what we think of as the phenomenological exposition of religion. Some have done that, of course. Christianity's been treating gay people terribly for a long time, and now we need to use our analysis to fix Christianity. I think it's right, but I think most people have tried to do that. If they're really trying to fix Christianity, they may critique Christianity, but they kind of...
It's something else, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they're
trying to heal Christianity or something.
Yeah, I think they're stepping over that line somehow.
I had a point about this sort of, I guess, this boundary that we're kind of considering as quite blurred between a contribution and purely like a descriptive kind of idea. I just thought of an example in the past couple of years. Mark Singleton and Jim Mellenson, they were writing a book, or they're planning to write a book called Roots of Yoga. And that was quite an interesting, I guess you can call it a case study, because they're writing that book mainly for practitioners, yet they're obviously academics, so they're putting it out as a wholly academic enterprise. Academic enterprise in their enterprise, but not academic in terms of the institution academic, because they explicitly couldn't... Well, they didn't try to get funding, or they couldn't get funding from an academic institution, and so they raised money independently, which was quite innovative, etc. But I thought... I'm not sure if it's completely comparative, but some of the things that I've studied in, for example, Christian theology, or what would be considered theology across the road, for example, it would be quite... So when you read some of the things, it seems that, okay, this could be considered as academic theology, but generally speaking, it's only going to be of use for example, as the roots of yoga would be generally aimed at or directed at those practitioners, this kind of, even the academic theology books are very much directed towards a specific niche, which would generally be a practitioner or a Christian or that kind of that kind of category.
And
I thought that just reminded me of the discussion we had last week, 2 weeks ago, about the imbalance that who mentions it? The imbalance in the last chapter of Clooney's book.
Paramahansa.
Yeah, Paramahansa.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions like an imbalance for a Hindu theology.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, his idea for Hindu theology is a bit different from what you're talking about.
It's interesting. I mean, just briefly, I'd be interested to talk more about Frank Clooney, but on that point, I think to me that's an example of the use of one discourse by the other discourse. The Mark Singleton, that yoga project was interesting because it did both.
Yeah.
So it said his academic study of the actual history origins and genuinely what was going on in yoga, let me give it now to practitioners to improve their practice. And that's a big movement in yoga, is to actually get more and more sense of what actually historically was going on and to use that. And I think that's really interesting. It's a fascinating move in that way. And there's also been the opposite. Early on in that project in Cambridge, I went to a seminar where lots of yoga practitioners came and spoke about their experience of yoga for the benefit of scholars who then said, oh, what can we learn from, as it were, insider theologians, in a sense? They weren't being systematic, but you know, people speaking from inside, in terms at least of the application of the material, what can we learn from them and how we understand the tradition? And while it was actually kind of a weird, not altogether successful event, because it was just so confusing to have people speaking in such different ways, in the long term, actually, for me in retrospect, it was helpful. It helped me to understand certain things about what's going on in meditative traditions in terms of practice in general, and what's entailed in trying to understand texts like the Yoga Sutra and any tradition of sort of practice bodily, mentally, etc. And I mean, my own feeling, I've said before, while I do religious studies, it would break my heart not to have theologians surrounding me. I wouldn't be as happy with my subject, but I think I have a much less good idea of what religion's about. And actually, again, controversially, if you go to faculties where people aren't working from within the tradition or working deeply, richly with what the tradition would be in a creative context, I think people lose sight of a lot. They actually start to do less good religious studies. That's just my own feeling. So that's part of, I think, saying that it should be, you know, Rembert's point, that the boundaries are mixed in actual faculties. I think you should have people moving back and forth, whether in discussion between the two discourses or in their own work. I can't remember what Frank Clooney's own personal definition of Hindu theology was.
I don't remember. I think it's faith-seeking understanding.
But he sets it out with the different points and how it could be, how it could be done, basically.
Okay, I'm interested. Because often when I go to his talks, it feels like he's doing simply an analysis of the texts.
Mm.
And I don't automatically see the theological side. Although what then happens is, having analysed the Hindu text from a what you might call a religious studies perspective, he then applies that theologically to Christianity. And that's where it becomes theological, which I think is an interesting activity in itself, although it's not Hindu theology, it's Christian theology using Hinduism, which is fine.
I think faith becomes a prerequisite in his theology, I think. Say, from what I understand, if you don't have faith, then it's perhaps not possible to engage in that kind of theological discourse. So therefore, the conclusions will be very different. A person could be situated in two different traditions simultaneously. But then if Clooney expects a person to be situated in a particular tradition, that would not be possible for some people.
I mean, it's an interesting question in his case, whether to do his kind of theology, then one has to be within the faith tradition as a theologian from the Christian perspective. I wonder whether as a Christian theologian he's doing different work on the Hindu material than he would do if he was just being a scholar. i.e. is he saying something different as a Christian about the actual Hindu material than he would if he was just sitting there studying it? He's certainly using that Hindu material differently to say things about Christianity, but I wonder if he's giving a particularly Christian theological interpretation of the Hindu material. I think he thinks he's not, but...
But he's encouraging. I think he's following Robert Dinabili and St. Paul in a very modified form, I would imagine so. Because he was using some of the hermeneutical tools used by his predecessors, but perhaps in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. So perhaps for his own Christian self-understanding, he engages with the Hindu text, and perhaps he's expecting a Hindu to engage with the Christian text in order to see how he or she would go back to her own text. Mm-hmm. It's going back and forth. That would suit certain types of people, not everyone, I would imagine.
Mm. But it's a really helpful point in some ways. I think what he's not doing is what people did at one time, which is Christians would go to the Hindu texts and saying, look, if you interpret Krishna as Jesus, actually, you get this out of it. And that was interesting Christian theology, but there was a concern that actually it wasn't representing the Hindu material correctly. I think he's not doing that. He wants to make sure he does represent the Hindu material correctly, and that's why Hinduism scholars love and respect him, because he does really good analysis of a lot of those texts and doesn't impose his Christianity onto them. I think he's quite responsible about that. What he then does is he applies that to his Christian confessional activity, and you're right, he then asks the Hindu material and Hindus within their own faith tradition interpretation of it to have a dialogue with him.
I think that's plausible, because he lays his precondition, like Bishop Newbegin some years ago, that you have to be rooted in your tradition. Make sure, once you're de-rooted, you get this freedom, if I understand him correctly. Once you're rooted in your tradition, you are sort of free to grace the entire field in the knowledge that you can come back to your own roots.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sort of enrich yourself without the center being challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Even if the center is challenged, the core will not be challenged, because that is a precondition there, that you tell yourself, whatever I might do, that core is my faith, that's what I stand by. So I thought this is how I read his. I could be wrong, I don't know.
I mean, in some ways, okay, there are issues we can ask about whether, you know, people used to say, is it the insider theologian or the outsider religious studies person who has a better view of the material? They used to have big fights about that, and I think there isn't an answer. They have different views and they're mutually illuminating. Yeah. But he, perhaps what the thing, one of the things that Frank does is remind a theologian what they're doing. As you say, he's speaking about what it is to be doing theology, regardless of what tradition you're in, actually. And you could look, maybe an interesting way to look at what Hindu theology would be to go to different theologians, broadly defined in both traditions, and see what they see their activity as entailing. Like, for instance, moving outward from a center of faith to a range of different views, but in the end sort of bringing them back into dialogue with that center of faith. So you could, maybe a good way to sort of expand the notion would be...
There should also be this room, once one's own faith can be challenged, we don't know, in the process of engaging with different texts. I mean, one's intellectual kind of understanding of one's own faith. But with the Roman Catholic tradition, there's a kind of expectation that certain doctrinal formulations cannot be changed, they have to be intact. The peripheral aspects can be changed, negotiated. But that's the Vatican pronouncement, isn't it? So, like within sampradayas, they might have their own pronouncements within Hindu sampradayas or whatever. I don't know whether I'm talking sense here, but...
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, every part of the coherence, that's part of the systematicity, the coherence within which any particular theological activity happens, is that each person, according to their own particular theological context, has certain rules that they have
But at the ordinary level, I think what Rooney does is quite interesting as an intellectual exercise, and people have the luxury of time and funding would be able to do it, certainly, okay? But at the empirical ordinary level, you find Hindus and Christians in India are engaging without using the sophisticated tools. There's constantly a kind of an interchange of ideas at different levels. Mm-hmm. Different discourses, as you pointed out, are taking place.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one is, for example, if you're reading Shakespeare, for example, if I'm reading a secular text like Shakespeare, I'm not for one minute thinking, well, am I going to be challenged? I should be sure that my faith is intact. I read Shakespeare with an open mind. That sense of an open-mindedness is somehow, when we read other texts, secular texts, you're not thinking constantly, am I going to be challenged? You read it because of the pleasure of reading it. And you're influenced by it in some ways. And you find lots of Indians quoting Shelley, Shakespeare, and Keats, either sometimes out of context or within context. So therefore, reading a religious text seems to take a different kind of meaning than reading a secular text. But for me, I think I would not make that distinction. You read a text for the sheer joy of it and see what the text has to tell you.
I was going to say, related to this point that came up in discussion 2 weeks ago as well, was that Clooney, obviously he's trying to kind of offer his take on Hindu theology or what you said, the Christian theology applied with the Hindu concepts. But I think he's also asking and kind of requesting, making a call for others to do in Hindu theology, like he's sort of saying, here's my version, come and tell me yours. And especially he wants Hindus to come and do that, which I think is interesting, but it's also quite important because when you do consider how, for example, maybe Christian theology is studied, there's no... If you take Hindu theology, whatever we might call it, its current manifestation is religious studies or through religious studies or through, for example, Oriental studies.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the two main kind of ways in which it can. Mm-hmm. So there's no, in the same, I guess the privilege that Christian theology has, perhaps you can call it a privilege. Maybe there's that category doesn't exist for Hindu theology. It's more taken through those other lenses.
In some ways, what I've spoken about is the distinction between theology and religious studies to kind of draw out that. Certain aspects of the definition, but to say more about what Hindu theology would be in some ways would be to look at the range of different ways in which Hindu theology is done or can be done, the different kinds of authority that it takes as the sources for its principles and premises and inspiration, the different modes and methods of reasoning, which of course very much are not always historical analysis, textual analysis, philosophical analysis as the kind of usual pillars of academic theology. Mm. I'm really interested in visual theologies, artists, poets, and in that whole creative realm, which is how most people encounter their religion, what actually is being expressed through those other kinds of media, because there is a reasoning behind them. Even if you look at the way temples develop architecturally, there is reasoning being expressed just by the builder. You know, it may be the artist, the sculptor, etc. And indeed, you know, if Tarka, the formal disputation between different philosophical positions in Hinduism and other traditions, was a major form of theological creativity, obviously, actually, just everyday people talking about it. Has always throughout history been one of the major sources of all theology. Problem is it's not written down and we haven't captured it. But for instance, one could now look at, you know, one can start to do records of that and see how theologies are developing through other media, as it were. And just as in disputation there are formal rules for who wins and who doesn't, maybe in the life of everyday conversation there are informal rules. The person who makes the most convincing argument, that's the argument that gets repeated, and that is the way that you sift for coherence and validity as you go along. But you know that I don't want the definition I've suggested to suggest only academic theology. I guess that there's a wider range, and that it would be useful to understand Hindu theology better to get a good unpicking and development and displaying of all the different things that theology actually can be.
I think to a great extent what one calls within brackets Hindu theology is being done in the West.
This is an issue.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there are a lot of Western scholars who show a great deal of interest in developing what one calls Hindu theology. And as you rightly pointed out, these visual theologies and other kinds of theologies are going on in the Indian context. And this particular terminology is not used, or perhaps things are not categorized in a particular systematic way as the West would do it. And it's only a minority of scholars in the American Academy of Religion now are sort of beginning to address this particular question of there are two camps. Some of them are happy with the use of the word theology. Some of them are not very happy with the use of the word theology.
Something, a book that I'd like to have been able to write, that I just have far too long a list of books to write, but I'd love to write a book on Hindu theology in the contemporary context that takes case studies of as many different kinds as I can imagine. And when I thought about what that book would entail, it included going to traditional sampradayas in India, both ones that are happening in a very quiet way in a village somewhere with a couple of people sitting in the village square chatting, but in terms of the sampradaya, into looking at them and what they're doing and analysing how they're working. Also looking at more formal sampradayas, if you still get debates happening in the grand Shankara Math, which has a sense of its own history and so on, how does that work? Also, in terms of, for instance, the Western academic development of Hindu theology, and to look at them as well, what kind of thing they're doing, and to analyse that. And then also to go to murti makers in Mahabalipuram, and see how they're mediating religious ideas and, Bollywood theology, and et cetera, so that you'd end up with a richer picture that puts those thinkers into context within a wider understanding of how Hindu theology works.
Well, a question to you, Jessica, I'm just thinking aloud here. Is it possible to use a different word other than the word theology again?
Mm-hmm.
Because the word theology has a lot of baggage in Western philosophical in Western history, let's put it, in Christian history. Given it's ambivalent, given the ambivalent relationship between theology and philosophy and religious studies and the whole baggage, again, using the word theology selectively and applying to Indian discourses, are we then in a different way perpetuating certain problems and which we had to constantly keep on disentangling in discourses? It's okay with the converted who know about it, that's fine. I'm just thinking...
Yeah, but are we introducing issues?
Yeah, again, for example, there's a lot of discourse about the use of the word religion. I mean, this is what I've said in what I'm writing right now. The scholars, religion scholars are debating, have been debating and are continuing to problematize the word religion because of the connotations that the term carries. And whether we'll end up discussing the word theology for years to come and keep using it.
And I think there are dangers of continuing to give life to controversial things because the controversy can eat up the actual activity you're supposed to be doing using that term. That's another, a different question, and I think it's maybe for the Hindu theologians to decide and not for me, but do I think it's a good or a bad idea? And is there an issue even talking about Hindu theology at all of simply imposing upon them a Western notion of theology so that I'm thereby obscuring the actual indigenous thing that happens? In some ways, I think all religious studies and all academic life uses existing concepts to try and make sense of new things. So at some level, just to speak of any kind of Hindu theology, I think is acceptable, just as you think of, you speak. Yeah. It's just a way of trying to understand the tradition from the concepts you're starting with. And the whole point of an academic's work is to improve our use of those concepts. But more specifically, really what you're asking is about whether modern Hindu theologians should want to call themselves Hindu theologians, whether it's really a good idea or not. And my answer is that what would the alternative words be? If they could find an alternative word that captured what they needed to capture, I think that would be fine. But I'm also a little bit cautious because it would be easy to say Hindu reflectors, reflection, religious reflection, Hindu thinkers. There's something in there that's, we might need a new word.
See, for example, the West, maybe I could be wrong, you just correct me here. Again, I'm thinking aloud here, okay? In the West, there's a distinction between at least, you know, theology and philosophy. There's a lot of tension in the use of these two words. But in the Indian context, the word philosophy is used generally, again, this is again, this is an English word, okay? Generally, the word so we need to find some kind of a word. What in the West, in the West we use the word theology to talk about God, and as you say, different sources, like, you know, you take source of authority as revelation, scripture, and you therefore find within the Hindu philosophical tradition, who are the philosophers like Shankara, Ramanuja, who use the text as a source of authority. So therefore, in one sense, it's understandable. But why can't we go by the term philosophy in the Indian, the Indian use of the word philosophy, rather than use theology? I'm just thinking, I don't know, I could be wrong here.
I know what you mean. I think, I mean, in some ways, I think that's a complex area that's important, but will take a while to look for the business of looking for other words one could use. Philosophy is a messy word with many different meanings in different contexts. And sometimes I think in the Indian context it almost is used more like darshana, a perspective on things. Using new words in different ways or specific ways, partly the answer is simply, let's be clear about the meanings we're using, because the philosophy in the Indian sense is profoundly different from the Western sense. So that in a sense, you know, it's just a different label, but there does need to be interesting thinking about new labels one could find. Sorry, go ahead, Robert.
Just about the, should we come up with a new term? You know what, there's about 10 years ago, there was this book that came out, Buddhist Theology, where there's a collection of Buddhist, a group of Buddhist scholars, a lot of, if not, most of which were Buddhist practitioners themselves, who sort of start thinking about this. And I think in the introduction of the book, I forget who wrote that introduction, but they raised that question, well, should we, you know, what sort of corresponds to theology in traditional Buddhist context, whether it's Japanese or Chinese or Indian or Pali and so on. And, you know, should we come up with a new term, you know, since Buddhism doesn't really have a god, should we come up with a Buddhology or a Dharmology or something like that? But in the end, they argue that functionally, there is some, you know, if you look at Christian theology, there's something in Buddhism that functions in exactly the same way, and why not just call that theology, even though, you know, there are some reservations with the term doesn't fully apply, but since functionally there's something that, well, there's something that functions in the same way, that is used, there's a sort of systematic reasoning that's used in the same way, why not just use that? And I think, in a way, that's why I would actually also argue that people like Shankara and Ramanuja and Mimamsa and so on is more theology than philosophy, because if you look at the nature of what they're doing and the way they reason, it comes closer to what we call theology in the West rather than philosophy.
I agree.
So that's what precisely I'm saying, because this term has currency in Western thinking, the due respect to it. There's nothing wrong about that. So therefore, it becomes much more easier to express some of the Indian theological categories, again, Indian concepts and thinking, through this Western framework. This is what I'm saying. I'm just putting it so badly, okay?
I mean, it also, just maybe the last points I'll make, but I think we're dealing with one messy thing that much academic life in general deals with, which is having to adopt and appropriate words for new contexts. And the words, we often reason analogically. We also often reason by analogy. So this is like this. And what we then do is we take the word theology and we adopt it for use in the Indian context. If we were going to be really, really good thinkers, we would say, well, wait a second, if theology has a particular, is a word with particular history, let's take out of it the meanings that make it applicable for use in the Indian context, and take those meanings and use those meanings. Like, we conceptually go up a level and be more concise about the actual meaning. So then we might say, instead of theology, we might say systematic religious creativity or something, right? Or whatever your particular definition is, but we'd use that. We'd be more specific. And we could do that. And I could then say, let's get rid of Hindu theology. And let's have everyone call themselves systematic religious creative thinkers. I could. It might not catch on. One of the funny things that Hindus do, that humans do, is that we aren't always good at using the terms. We're not good at speaking in a concise way with all the details expressed in that form. The sentences get messy, everything is complicated. We like short, neat terms, and we often create new words by borrowing them from other contexts. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that we have to keep theology. I think that there can be dangers in taking a word from one context and taking them to another. But it means that in order to even create a new word, half the time we're going to be borrowing some other word. And that's how new words, how theology was created as a word itself, you know, so that, we can't get, we have to be reasonable.
It's okay. You've got the right to use the word theology. Okay. I'm just thinking aloud, that's all.
No, I think it's an interesting point. It's a plus. Go ahead.
Or if you start saying, well, we should have a sort of a Hindu term for it, it means that you have the Hindus are kind of have their own term that sort of denotes their discipline, and then the Buddhists have their own term, and the Christians have their own term, and then I suppose the Jewish thinkers have to come up with their own term, which kind of leads to just... Yeah. Makes all everything a lot more complicated.
And that in due course, you're right, that would be the alternative. You could have, you know, darshana or anvikshiki or something like this, and then you could have the Hindu word, and then you could have... But then you'd be also eliding the fact, you'd be obscuring the fact that there is an analogous structure of reasoning that you're pointing to in all of these contexts. Because it's neither simply saying they're the same, nor saying they're totally different that you're pointing to. So that doesn't solve our, doesn't help our task either. I think you're quite right.
I was just going to mention as well, I was going to just add to that functional aspect that, for example, in my application, I had to mention theology. If I don't mention theology or religion and try and, you know, I think we're at the stage now where we have to use these terms functionally, and then, I don't know, maybe in another time or something. But also, the point that you raised, I think, is quite important, because if you try and transport the word theology over to India, I think the connotations of the word theology would be much more Christian than what we have sort of developed in our Western, particularly academic context. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be...
There's a lot of, like, using the word appropriate to context.
And also, the word theology is very restrictive in one sense. Mm-hmm. It theos refers to God, am I correct?
Yeah.
So in one sense, in the Indian understanding, as you're all the experts here, you have the non-dualistic understanding of the formless Brahman. And even those who do not profess a faith in a particular deity or God could be seekers after truth. So in one sense, going back to Buddhism, so in one sense, the word theology can be used, as you said, but it's a bit restrictive in the sense like...
But I think...
There are certain problems, that's all. If one explains, that's fine.
Yeah, no, I think... But I mean, also, we're not looking for one word that will be perfect for... You know, we're not expecting one word perfect.
Yeah.
One of the things, hopefully, scholars were saying is, I think the people who want to label themselves Hindu theology are not thinking, I'm going to go to India, sit in the middle of the village square and say, I'm a Hindu theologian, let me help you explore your religious life. Mm. They're thinking of how they're going to go to the academic world. And specifically... engaging with the history of theology as an academic term, I think you're right. They need to be, they need to adapt to their context. But I think it's also, it can be meaningful to take a word from another culture. I remember when I discovered the meaning of the word sadhana in Hinduism, kind of a discipline practice. That was a word for which I didn't really have a Western equivalent, and it was really useful to take the Indian word and apply it in my own life, mostly to say things like, darn, I wish I had a sadhana. But, you know, it's... I think that we also do that, you know, and if you look in every culture at the way in which we borrow words across cultures, that's
that's one way to justify, I suppose.
Well, it's just something that, done in the right way, can be affirmative and can be just simply useful. Deciding what is the right way, that is not my job. I'll leave that to the Hindu theologians.
It could be theology as a word from English, as Remba made a point the other week, that's gone into India. I mean, we've got like bhakti and gurus, yoga, sadhana,
exactly.
And so on. So
exactly. And once you change it, it changes and has a new meaning. Yeah, indeed.
Like how people use like Christian yoga and Christian sadhana, it's...
Perhaps we need to be more creative and assertive about our use of language.
I think there's a strong case for vagueness, actually, in language. So it's allowed us to have this interesting discussion. Thanks very much, Jessica, for sharing your thoughts with us. And we look forward to hearing more about this in the future.